Say my name! Say my name!
No one is around you. Say, baby, I love you. You ain't running game.
Say my name! Say my name!
You acting kinda shady. Ain't calling me baby. Why the sudden change?
Say my name! Say my name!
If no one is around you. Say, baby, I love you. If you ain't running game.
Say my name! Say my name!
You acting kinda shady. Ain't calling me baby. Better
say my name!
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You fat, delete.
You haven't been beat up properly.
Welcome to episode 516 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 8th. 2017. I am the Sala Monster. Thank you to everybody who sent in birthday wishes on social media. My day of birth has come and gone, and I have survived another year. I guess every year you wake up on your birthday, you open your eyes, is a good one. I know I'm setting the bar very low, but it was a good birthday. I wanted to just say thank you to everybody who remembered, or more likely, everybody who Facebook reminded. So, I wanted to say thank you. The other thing I wanted to mention here up front, very excited about this, I kind of mentioned it last week. Audible has been obviously a great supporter of this podcast, and the new Jim Ross book, Slobberknocker, is in fact now available to download on audible.com. It is narrated by the man himself, good old JR, almost 11 hours worth of audio, and it can be yours for free by using our link to sign up for a 30-day Audible trial. That is, of course, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. And remember, I mean, as you guys know, even if you cancel, for whatever reason, before the 30 days are up, and you are not billed, you get to keep your Jim Ross book for free. And this is a big one. You know, JR is one of those guys, you know, Vince McMahon himself probably being at the head of the pack. And I know, you know, we've all heard JR tell a lot of stories on his podcast over the years, but he's a guy who's been around for a very long time, who's worked for a number of different people, who sort of knows where the bodies are buried, so to speak, and has an interesting story to tell. And you can have that book now for free. And boy, it would be nice. It would be a nice belated birthday gift if we could get a lot of you guys to sign up and grab your Jim Ross book. So go for it. audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Let's all represent the sound off here and crush it with the link this week and get yourself a free book. And of course, it doesn't have to be the Jim Ross book. I'm just putting that out there because it is brand new. And I think a lot of you would probably have an interest in that. So take advantage. It was a rough week. I didn't have a chance to talk about it last week because I had already recorded my show. There really isn't too much left to say about what happened in Las Vegas last week. Just an awful situation. A lot of very sick individuals, unfortunately, walking the earth. And also, as if that wasn't bad enough, what happened there last week, we had the deaths of Tom Petty and Lance Russell. I actually think Tom Petty's death was unfortunately overshadowed by all of the Las Vegas stuff. I think he'll be one of those guys now who goes down where, you know, you'll bring his name up to people every now and then, and when they learn he passed away, they'll be shocked because the news was sort of, I don't want to say swept under the rug, it just sort of got lost, I think, in all the noise of what was happening. But I was always a big Tom Petty fan. I never saw him in concert or anything like that, but I can, you know, rattle off at least four or five different songs of his that I have loaded up on my phone that I'm a big fan of, so I know he had just performed, I think he had just wrapped up a tour, and there was some footage of him performing maybe a week or two, not even 2 weeks ago, and then this happens. I guess it was a heart attack, cardiac arrest, so very, very sad to hear about that. I think he was 66, and then, of course, Lance Russell, who passed away on Tuesday morning, 91 years old, a central figure in pro wrestling, the voice of Memphis wrestling, the man who gave Jerry Lawler his start in the wrestling business, not a wrestler or as a wrestler, but as an artist, you know, because Lawler would do drawings of the show. Lawler is a very a very, very good artist, even to this day. And that's how he got his foot in the door in wrestling. And Lance Russell would put his drawings on TV from all the local shows, and then it sort of went from there. But you've not heard a bad word said about the guy all week. I have not heard a single negative word used by anybody who knew Lance Russell, worked with him. And that's a rare thing. I think that's, especially in wrestling, I think that's a very rare thing. Lawler, on his podcast, Dinner with the King, he explained what happened. And I don't know, maybe some of the dates or times were a little shaky on this, but this is what Lawler was saying on his show, which I listened to the other day. And it really is a sad story. So Lance's daughter, Valerie, had been battling cancer for the last year. And I guess recently she took a turn for the worse. Lance didn't really know how bad his daughter had gotten. I guess the family intentionally hid that from him. But then recently she got sicker. He had been living in Florida in recent years. And so I guess he came back to Tennessee to be around her. And his son lives there. So I think he was staying with his son. He was staying at his son's house, so he woke up in the morning, and he fell in the bathroom. Broke his hip. According to Lawler, broke a bone in his neck. Was in just agonizing pain. His son heard screaming, went upstairs to see, you know, what was going on. And he was just in so much pain, I guess, at the hospital, they gave him a morphine drip, which pretty much knocked him out. That sedated him. I mean, that's what they gave my mother when she was in the hospital last month. So I know how powerful that stuff is. So meanwhile, the day that Lance fell, that right, he fell in the morning, that same day later on is when his daughter passed away. So imagine that. Imagine waking up in the morning and this, if you're his son and that happens to him and you got to rush him to the hospital and then you find out that your sister passed away only a few hours later. That's a shitty situation right there. And Lance never really woke up from being sedated. I mean, he passed away about a day or two after his daughter did. I think the same day as her funeral, in fact, is when he died. Just an awful situation for that entire family to have to go through. You know, the one thing, and Lawler said this and I agree, you know, the one thing is that he was spared the news of his daughter's death. You know, because that news alone probably would have been the end of him. But it's really too bad, you know, that Jerry Lawler didn't get his wish to have Lance be the one to induct him into the WWE Hall of Fame back in 2007, I think, or whenever it was. He wanted Lance to be the one to induct him, and really there wouldn't have been anybody more appropriate, given their history, to do it. He pitched for it. As the story goes, Kevin Dunn shot the idea down because nobody knows who Lance Russell is, so they went with William Shatner instead. Because he gave Lawler a monkey flip one time on Raw 20 years ago. Meanwhile, there would be no Jerry the King Lawler were it not for Lance Russell. Good on Mauro Ranallo for mentioning Lance at the top of the show on NXT this week. He snuck in one of Lance's signature catchphrases before Ruby Riott's entrance. The only mention of him on WWE programming, I guess he would have died the day after Raw, so they wouldn't have had anything on Raw, but they didn't have any mentions, even just a quick mention on SmackDown or anything like that. And I know, you know, they already had everybody out on stage both nights. They did the moment of silence on stage, which was very nice of them to do, you know, in lieu of the Vegas shootings. But I think it would be nice if they let Lawler say a few words about him, maybe on the pre-show tonight, if he's on there. I don't know if Lawler's on the pre-show for this pay-per-view. I know he does pre-show stuff for some of them. The way I look at it, if they can dedicate an entire video package to Jennifer Lopez like they did a few weeks ago, surely they can acknowledge the death of Lance Russell and say a few words. I didn't forget about my PayPal VIPs. You guys were beast this week. So keep on donating if you want to. TheSolemonster.com, you'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on this show. We are heading to the 10-year anniversary show at the beginning of next month. I'll have more information on that probably next week. So hopefully we can really make an impression there on that show. I mean, the roll call for episode 500 back in June was insane. So now we have the 10-year anniversary show, which of course will be a special one. And so get ready for that. But I want to say thank you here to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Massgrave Micah Harshaw, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Brett Brickfist Brode, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Bakersfield Brawler Kevin Velado, Stephen Handyman Halistic, Davis the Empire Enos, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Cody Heartbreaker Hatch, Deathblow David Floyd, Beautiful Bobby Younger, the God of Justice Giovanni Turner, Rockchester Ruff Victor De Leon, Caleb Blackout Brinkman, Slingblade Shane McDonough, and I know I already said this in my email to her, but congrats to you and Christian on the engagement. They bought me French fries once. Yes, they did. If I remember, I think it was out in California, for WrestleMania 31. I think. I could be wrong. I've seen them at a bunch of events. So thank you for the French fries, and congratulations on the engagement. The Chilean Chief, Edgar Gelez, first-time donator, so thank you to Edgar. Money Mel Aqua, also a first-time donator. Thank you, Mel. Shout out to Simon and his wife Shawnee on the birth of their son Igor Asimov Ed, who was born last Tuesday. A better delivery than what WWE delivered to us with SmackDown Live. So congratulations to them. And the Wilmington Warlord, last but not least, Tyler Williams, who is hosting a WWE 2K18 live stream on the midnight release of the game this Friday, October 13. Ooh, Friday the 13th. He and his cousin Darren will be streaming the game live for 3 hours, during which they are also going to be hosting a giveaway of WWE 2K18 for any platform. So to enter the raffle, you need to sub to his channel and be watching the live stream. Find it on YouTube, youtube.com/Tyler Williams. That'll take you right to the channel. They're going to be streaming all weekend for those of you who miss it live, but in terms of the giveaway and all that, you can tune into the live midnight stream. I plan to grab my copy of 2K18 for PC. It's going to be available via Steam when it drops the following Tuesday, October 17th. And this is cool because when they, I don't know about 2K17, but when they came out with 2K16, that was many months after the game had already come out for all the other major platforms. So I think this is the first time where it's dropping for PC on the same day as it is for most platforms. So finally, I'm going to upgrade from 2K16 to 2K18, and you know what that means. Brand new Sound of Gamer content, exploring the new game. This could be very bad. I think either way, it'll be fun for you to watch. It might be very frustrating for me. So we'll see how that goes. I'm looking forward to that. Speaking of 2K18, this would be a good time to mention this, because I know this got people very animated this week. Roman Reigns will have a 95 out of 100 score in the new game, making him, according to this game, as far as 2K18 is concerned, the greatest of all time. Roman Reigns, the greatest of all time. Now, that 95 rating is up from, I guess, last year was an 89 rating that he had. So to compare, I got this from one of the video game sites, so if this is wrong, blame them. But to compare his score to others in the game, I guess there's a 1997 version of Stone Cold Steve Austin in the game. He gets a 92 rating. The Rock, I don't know from what year, but The Rock in the game gets a 93 rating. John Cena and Brock Lesnar, okay, the same Brock Lesnar who has been Universal Champion, beating people left and right, has a 93 rating. And he is the champ. Finn Balor and Seth Rollins, or at least I think Demon Balor and Seth Rollins, each have a 92 rating. AJ Styles has a 90. Jinder Mahal, 88. And Braun Strowman, 87. So apparently the ratings are based solely on their TV personas and their level of popularity. There's no statistical formula that goes into it the way it does for, say, an NFL game or an NBA game. Just looking at this year, I mean, Roman beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania, and then he didn't win another pay-per-view match until he beat John Cena at No Mercy, which by then I don't even think that would factor into his rating here in the game. But apparently this has a lot of people very upset, all the gamers out there, but it also has people talking about the game, which is exactly what they wanted. You can change the rating. I mean, if it bothers you that much, apparently you can change the rating, but you're going to have to pay extra to do so. More money for the big dog. All right, let's talk about Hell in a Cell. There is a pay-per-view tonight presented by the SmackDown brand. And I'll run through the predictions, and in doing so, I'll talk about what happened on the show last Tuesday. There's no sense in me doing that separately at this point. Hell in a Cell is taking place from the Little Caesars Arena in Detroit, Michigan. Now, I've talked about these arena names and stadium names getting out of control. Okay, here's another example. The Little Caesars Arena. Although I have to say, this does not hold a candle to the stadium where the Chicago White Sox play. I don't know how I didn't know about this before this week, but it came to my attention this week that the White Sox got a new sponsor for their stadium last year. It is now called Guaranteed Rate Field. Guaranteed Rate Field. I guess it's a mortgage company or something. And worse, their logo includes an arrow pointing downward. What sports team wants an arrow pointing down to represent them? I mean, I can think of a few teams who should have an arrow pointing down to represent them. I live in a town with one of these teams. But I mean, really, what sports team wants that in their logo? A shit name and a shit logo for a shit team. And that's coming from a Mets fan. We had a shit team this year, too. I know all about shit teams. But I'll take Citi Field over Shitty Field over there in Chicago. I actually feel bad for you guys. I feel bad for the White Sox fans. Anyway, it was 20 years ago this past Thursday that we had the very first, and I would argue still the best, Hell in a Cell match between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. That match also featured the debut of Kane. Again, I would argue, still the best debut for anyone in WWE history. I think I ranked them once. I know I've been asked about this. I think I put Kane number one, Chris Jericho number two, and maybe Taz number three is how I rank the debuts over the years. And also, on that same day, and I've talked about Kane. I mean, there really isn't anything left to say that I haven't already. I mean, the longevity this guy has had. I know he's been off TV lately, but he's got an excuse. He's running for office. And I'm sure if it doesn't work out, he'll be back on TV in no time. But I could think of few people, in terms of WWE anyway, who have had the kind of longevity that Kane has had. Obviously, he's an instant Hall of Famer. If anything, I think he's underrated by some people, because we remember a lot of awful Kane matches and Kane segments from recent years. The stuff with him and Big Show and the Authority, you know, oh my God. But, I mean, Kane, the way he's been able to adapt, whether he was a serious monster type or if he, you know, they had him doing the comedy stuff with Hurricane and Daniel Bryan, he could do it all. He could be serious, he could be goofy. He could be corporate, right? I mean, the guy has just adapted to whatever they've wanted him to do. He can just be plugged into any hole, any role they have open and they need him for. He truly, I think, will go down as one of the all-time greats in that company. You know, where he would fit in the top 10? I don't know. I'd have to give that. There's been a lot of really great guys who have worked for WWE over the years. So I don't know where, let's say, in a top 10 he would rank, or if it would even, if there would even be room for him in a top 10. If he's not, though, he's close. And his debut, like I said, is the best debut of anybody I've ever seen. Now, also on that same day, back in 1997, Brian Pillman passed away, found dead in his hotel room. Somebody who I think was far ahead of his time with that crazy character that he was portraying there the last couple of years of his life. And I don't doubt that some of that bled into his real life, which is probably why he passed away when he did. But it was just a tragedy in that had he never gotten in that accident, I mean, he never really had the chance to show people, show fans in WWE once he came over what he was physically capable of because of the ankle injury from the Hummer crash. He would have been a guaranteed rival for Steve Austin after Austin won the WWF title. There's not a doubt in my mind about that. I've said that over the years, and I stick with that. That, you know, even with the injury, so even if he had the ankle injury and you know, had lived and did not jump back to WCW, which that was the rumor that he wanted to go back to WCW at the time of his death, and I'm sure after what happened to Bret in Montreal, that would have been it. I would think that he would have probably taken the same approach that Bulldog did and would have wanted out to go with him to WCW. But even, you know, if he still had the ankle injury and him not being 100%, I think it would have been Brian Pillman and not Dude Love in that spot immediately after WrestleMania feuding with Steve Austin. I mean, Pillman in the Attitude Era would have been something else. He would have fit right in there like a glove. And it's a shame he never had that chance. So October 5th, 1997, one of the more eventful days in wrestling history. Hell in a Cell, the kickoff match will be Chad Gable and Shelton Benjamin against the Hype Bros. And I would imagine this is probably where the split finally happens with Zach and Mojo. Gable and Jordan, obviously my pick to win. No reason to beat them this early. And you're going to need some challengers for those tag team titles. And the Hype Bros, their days are numbered. There's no reason for them to win this match. We have the return of the Fashion Files with Fandango and Tyler Breeze being advertised. It was advertised originally for SmackDown last Tuesday, but they decided to hold it off for the pay-per-view. Apparently this one is going to be based around the movie Pulp Fiction. Bobby Roode against Dolph Ziggler. Bobby Roode should not be losing to this scrub. I'm sorry. I don't care how many matches they go on to have. You got to give Dolph a win. No, you don't. They should do this one and then do another one on the Halloween episode of SmackDown. Hopefully the Halloween Havoc episode of SmackDown. And they could do that straitjacket match or some variation of that I pitched here on the podcast a few weeks ago. And then they can put Ziggler in the nut house, because that's at this point, I think, where he belongs. So Bobby Roode is my pick. Randy Orton against the Mighty Rusev. I love the Mighty Rusev, don't get me wrong. But I think Randy Orton is winning this match. We have a tag team Hell in a Cell match, the Usos against the New Day, which sets up either the returning Harper and Rowan, I would think. I mean, those guys have been MIA now for weeks. Perhaps they will resurface as the next challengers for the tag titles, or maybe a call-up from NXT, the Authors of Pain, sometime in the fall. I mean, I know they're going to be on the next TakeOver show, so it probably wouldn't be until after that. But maybe coming out of that TakeOver show in Houston, that would be a good time maybe to debut them on TV. But I think the New Day retains, and they do move on to one of those two scenarios. The Usos have been killing it. They've been doing their best work, I think, in their entire run in WWE. I've been enjoying it. The last match on, that was on the pre-show, technically, not even the pay-per-view. But back at SummerSlam, the match they had was tremendous. They had a match on TV a few weeks ago that was also very good. Now you put them in the Cell. I'm sure they're going to come up with all these things they want to do. It's a good way, I think, to cap off this feud, and I think the New Day will retain. Charlotte and Natalya for the SmackDown Women's Championship. We saw Charlotte tap out to the Sharpshooter in a tag team match last Tuesday. I still think Natty retains. I just don't think they're going to do the title change here. We may get a Money in the Bank cash-in tease. In fact, I expect one. But I don't think it actually happens on this show. Although Carmella may factor into the finish in some way, I don't see her cashing in and losing or winning. I just don't see the actual cash in going through. And I think Natty, come hell or high water, walks out with the title. By the way, it's October, in case you didn't already know this, which means two things. Number one, time to book a Hell in a Cell match. And the pink rope for Susan G. Komen. They had a segment on SmackDown last week, and also on Raw, they did it back-to-back nights, where all of the women on the roster were lined up in the ring to watch the Ultimate Warrior's widow, Dana Warrior, present three breast cancer survivors with custom women's championship belts. You guys know, okay, this is something that hits close to home for me. This, what they do here with this, I personally don't like it. I just think it reeks of exploitation, but to each their own. I think it's comical, though, that they've turned the Ultimate Warrior, and I know this has been a topic of debate this week online, so I'll chime in here. I do think it's comical how they've turned the Ultimate Warrior into this saintly figure. And they have his wife out there hosting breast cancer segments using quotes from him. Quotes from his career. After the twisted shit that he said, reveling in the fact that Bobby Heenan had cancer. And this is going back over a decade. People change. People soften in their old age. Maybe Warrior had regrets. We'll never know because we can't ask him. But he said some really twisted shit about Bobby Heenan, who was no fan of the Ultimate Warrior, and I'm sure Warrior was not happy about Bobby Heenan on that self-destruction DVD talking crap about him. Although a lot of people talk crap about him on that DVD because that's what WWE wanted. But Bobby Heenan was never an Ultimate Warrior fan. Like, I understand that. He's made that very clear for a number of years. How reckless he thought Warrior was and how Warrior hurt him when they had their weasel suit matches and all that kind of stuff. So that is true. But that's not something you forget. That's not something you go, oops, I made a mistake. Or you should do that, but I don't think he ever did. And yet here is a segment about breast cancer and breast cancer survivors. And there's Dana out there giving inspirational Ultimate Warrior quotes. As if he'd be the one out there, you know, saying and doing all of these things. So I find that amusing. But they had Carmella. Here's the other thing I am not a fan of. They had Carmella and Becky Lynch out there, standing just feet away from each other. Only a few segments after Carmella hit her with a briefcase. And they did the same thing on Raw the night before with Alexa Bliss and Mickie James. Out there together after fighting each other. Only a few segments earlier. Now they're all just the best of friends. This does not need to be on TV. You could do it during a dark segment. You could do it during one of the 7,000 commercial breaks. I don't like this being on TV. My opinion. We had AJ Styles and Baron Corbin for the United States Championship. Ty Dillinger, by the way, beat Corbin with a small package on the Go Home episode of SmackDown. Baron Corbin is challenging for the championship. Ty Dillinger is not. Only way this makes any sense, and it's why I'm picking Baron Corbin to win the match and to win the U.S. title. Only way this makes any sense is if Corbin wins the championship tonight, which then sets up Dillinger as the number one contender because he could argue, look, I pinned this guy on TV, I deserve a shot. And we know AJ is going to get an automatic rematch. So what it would set up is the match that I was hoping they would do on this show, but they could easily set it up for Survivor Series now, a triple threat match for the U.S. title with Corbin, at that point, defending against AJ and Ty Dillinger. So because of that, I think Corbin wins the title here. And if he doesn't win the title here, then that was a pretty stupid thing for them to do on Tuesday. We have Shinsuke Nakamura and Jinder Mahal for the WWE Championship. You see that Nakamura segment on SmackDown last Tuesday, the in-ring promo that he did? I'm sure many of you saw that, right? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That's what they had Nakamura out there saying on the Go Home show. What is he, seven? They've officially announced two dates in India. In December, December 7th and 8th. Those are Raw brand events. They are advertising the WWE champion Jinder Mahal on those shows. Jinder comes home. Jinder also just got new custom side plates for the WWE championship with his name on it. Sure does give you the impression that this guy's walking out of here with the championship, doesn't it? I think he is. It's not what I would do. But my prediction is that Jinder Mahal retains the WWE Championship. And I hate saying that because I am so done with this reign. But this looks like more the beginning than the end. So I'm picking Jinder. And that brings us to Shane McMahon and Kevin Owens. Now, falls count anywhere. Inside Hell in a Cell. Let me repeat that. Falls count anywhere. In a Hell in a Cell match. That makes about as much sense as that Killshot Dante Fox match from Lucha Underground, starting out as a First Blood match with those guys out there using weapons, bleeding all over the place, and then the very next fall is a no disqualification match. The whole point of Hell in a Cell with the top on the cage is to try to keep people inside the cell. And I guess you could argue keep them out of it too, but you want to keep those guys inside, locked inside the cell, right? And I know that rarely happens. I know they've had cell matches that end outside the cell. They've had Hell in a Cell matches that have ended on top of the cell. So I guess inherently the match has been false count anywhere anyway, or at least when it's convenient to them. But they had Shane out here announcing, formally announcing, we are adding a false count anywhere stipulation to a match that, in effect, has two guys that are supposed to be locked inside the cell. So false count anywhere. Oh, you could pin me, I guess, outside the ring between the cage. You could pin me over there. You can pin me in this corner. It's so stupid. So now they just admit, look, we know you guys are going to find your way out. So let's just go ahead and call it false count anywhere. Then why not make this a false count anywhere match? Oh, that's right. It's October. I forgot about that. October means Hell in a Cell. And I actually think doing this match in Hell in a Cell makes a lot of sense because this is a personal feud. Matches like this belong inside Hell in a Cell. But if that's what they were going to do, they should have just made it false count anywhere in the building and put Jinder and Nakamura in Hell in a Cell to keep out the Singh brothers. Not that that would have worked. I mean, it didn't work in the Punjabi prison match, although here we have a top on the cage. But at least that would have made more sense. I am looking forward to the match. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not just, you know, hating on the match. I'm just hating on some of the illogical nonsense here. But I am looking forward to the match. In fact, I want to play a very quick clip here for you from May of last year. Episode 439 of The Sound Off. Episode 439 here for Sunday, May 8th, 2016. I am the Solemn Monster. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from St. Louis, Missouri. Hits and misses this week. Kevin Owens, as usual. One of the highlights of the show, he interrupted Shane McMahon yet again. And this is like the second or third time now that he's interrupted Shane and they've jaw-jacked back and forth. And I have no idea if this is the direction they're going in or not. But I see these two guys in the ring together and I would love to see a match between them. I don't know why. I really feel like the two of them would go in there and have like a street fight and would just tear the house down. So I'd love to see it. So let it be known, I've wanted to see this match for a long time. That was the first time I ever mentioned my wanting to see Shane McMahon and Kevin Owens in a fight. I just felt like the two of them would have good chemistry together, and here we are. A year and a half later, we're about to find out tonight just how good their chemistry really is. I enjoyed the brawl they had at the end of SmackDown last week. I love it when guys wrestle all over the building. It's not often we get to see Shane McMahon get powerbombed through a concession stand table up on the concourse, which is what happened here. Owens walked back to the ring, flat out admitted, I'm throwing you off the cell. Like, we're not staying in the cage. We're going to get out of the cage, we're going to climb up to the top, and I'm going to pop up powerbomb you. Well, he didn't say that, but I'm sure they'll tease that. Actually, you know what? I would not put it past Shane to take a pop-up powerbomb from the top of the cage on some sort of gimmicked platform. Like, Rikishi got chokeslammed backwards once by Undertaker onto, like, a flatbread. Yes, Rikishi got chokeslammed onto a flatbread truck, which I'm sure must have made him very happy. No, that was that Armageddon pay-per-view, and they did the six-man Hell in a Cell. Rikishi got tossed off, so it's possible. Shane's a crazy man. I don't doubt for a second that he would be willing to take a bump like that. So, who knows what's going to happen tonight. But there he is. Like, again, Owens is just in the ring saying, I'm going to, you know, throw you off the cell. Why even have a door? Just have Kane come out and rip the door off its hinges again for old time's sake and just make it easier for these two guys to get out. Why even have a door? Shane stumbled back down to the ring as one female fan in the crowd was twerking next to him on camera. At least I think that's what she was doing. I mean, maybe it was muscle spasms. I don't know. But in the ring, Shane gave him a headbutt. No blood this time. And then a pop-up powerbomb. What I would do, I would have Nakamura win the championship, and I would have Kevin Owens win this match to set up Owens as the next one in line to challenge for the title. And that gives you an Owens-Nakamura feud. through Royal Rumble time. Because I think Jinder is retaining, though, and because there's advertising out suggesting Kevin Owens may be headed to the Raw brand. Yes, Kevin Owens may be headed to Raw very soon. Possibly as early as next week. I know he's being advertised, or was anyway, earlier in the week for the Raw show on October 16th in Portland. Because of all those factors, I think Shane McMahon wins this match. I think Shane wins here, and then I think he either fires Owens or Owens quits on SmackDown this Tuesday. Now, if Owens does end up staying on SmackDown and does not go to Raw, he absolutely needs to win this match so they can set him up as the number one contender. He's been one of the best things about SmackDown now for weeks, is this sort of sadistic, violent version of Kevin Owens. But if he's leaving, then it doesn't matter. You can give Shane a win here. People like Shane McMahon. He'll wrestle more matches in the future, and so it's good to give him a win every now and then so he doesn't just lose every time he's in a big match. But what a slap in the face to SmackDown if they do move Owens over to Raw and they don't move somebody from Raw to SmackDown, someone like Samoa Joe, who's due back, I think, next month. If they move Owens and SmackDown doesn't get somebody of equal or greater value in return, that tells you everything you need to know right there about where SmackDown ranks in the pecking order in that company. Monday Night Raw, this past week, was live from Denver, Colorado. Raw poll had over 2,100 votes, 47% thumbs up, 53% thumbs down. So this Shield reunion is really happening. It's likely happening tomorrow night after what happened on this show. Cesaro and Sheamus interfered in Miz's Intercontinental title match with Roman Reigns. This was after the Miztourage earlier in the show had done the old Shield entrance through the crowd. Thankfully, it does not look to be The Miz, Bo Dallas, and Curtis Axel wrestling The Shield at TLC. Instead, Cesaro and Sheamus, it looks like it will be them possibly teaming up with The Miz, or I think more likely as Braun Strowman. I think Miz gets bumped from the match to defend the Intercontinental title in a rematch against Jason Jordan at TLC. And Strowman becomes the third man in that match. Strowman has now beaten Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins on consecutive weeks, back to back. And obviously he's had his issues in the past with Roman Reigns. He has no other match, no other obvious match, at the pay-per-view. Miz, at least, still has that issue with Jordan to fall back on. So he could very easily be slotted again with him, and you could do the rematch for the IC title. I think that's what's going to end up happening. Rollins and Ambrose, by the way, did not save Roman from the beatdown he suffered here on this show. He got triple powerbombed, but they did all have a little stare down in the back. At the very end of the show, Roman is licking his wounds, sitting in the back, and all of a sudden Ambrose sidles up to him and they're staring at each other, and then in comes Seth Rollins into camera view and they're all staring. No words were exchanged. They all stared. They all sort of nodded. They kind of knew. It was almost like an acknowledgement that after talking about, well, you know, Dean and Seth, they're doing their thing, I'm doing mine, and basically shooting down any idea of a full-blown Shield reunion, this was the first acknowledgement, the first silent acknowledgement on their part that, okay, we see what has to be done. We know what needs to be done now. And it's too bad they never changed Roman's theme song, because bringing back the old song would have been just an instant pop. And instead, it's going to be boos. I'm sure the boos will slowly morph into cheers. But, you know, Rollins, look, you look at the Shield. Rollins has evolved since the split. Ambrose evolved. He got his own music, just like Seth did, changed his ring attire. Reigns, though, I mean, after all these years, same music, minus a few minor changes to it, but by and large, it's the same theme song. Same gear. At least he ditched the blue contact lenses. I know Vince had him wearing blue contact lenses for a while. But I've seen this little tidbit floating around this week online that it was in Indianapolis that the Shield formed and made their debut at Survivor Series back in 2012. It was on Raw in Indianapolis that Rollins turned on Ambrose and Reigns and broke up the Shield. And tomorrow night, they're back in Indianapolis, and it sure does look like we're going to have ourselves a Shield reunion. So I guess that means that when they all go into the Hall of Fame together in 20 years, That'll be the year they bring WrestleMania back to Indianapolis. That's what I get out of this whole thing. Elias. Elias won himself a new fan in me on this show Monday night by covering the song Nutshell by Alice in Chains before his win over Titus O'Neil. I have had a love-hate, mostly hate relationship with the Drifter ever since I first saw him in NXT. He has slowly been winning me over, and I think he might have done that on Monday night with that performance. That song depresses the hell out of me every time I hear it, but I love it. I think it's just a fantastic song. I have the MTV Unplugged version on my phone. It really is fantastic. Everybody should listen to it. His version wasn't bad either. Bray Wyatt. Have him here to talk about in my notes. Bray Wyatt was on the Titantron reacting to Finn Balor in this feud that simply will not die. He outright said that Sister Abigail is alive and that she is dying to meet Finn Balor. And they added some special effects to make Wyatt look like some sort of, demon or scarecrow or whatever effect they were going for here. We only saw a little bit. His hair was sort of covering his face. He almost looked zombified in a way. It was hard to see. But he reminded me of that girl from The Ring. I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about. This set social media ablaze with speculation about, finally, the debut of Sister Abigail. Who's going to play her? Who's going to portray her on TV? Even though it was earlier this year in his feud with Randy Orton that he did a segment on SmackDown that showed Randy Orton burning down a shack, okay, with the remains of what was said to be Sister Abigail buried in there. That's what set Bray off, right? That's why Bray freaked out. The remains of Sister Abigail. That's what Orton said to us. And he burned the whole thing down, and Wyatt had a meltdown. That was the build-up, by the way, to a WrestleMania match. Now, a few years ago, if you remember, I suggested Crazy Mary Dobson would make a fine Sister Abigail. Just by looking at her and just watching some video of her, I thought, you know what? She could play the part of Sister Abigail. Now she's with NXT. She actually works for them now. She's Sarah Logan. She's doing this country girl gimmick, farm girl gimmick. I still think she would be a fine choice if there was to be a Sister Abigail. But the thing is, so much time has passed on the Sister Abigail stuff. I just don't see the point. Like, and picking an established person to portray her, like Paige, who is due back soon, that would just be a dumb idea. I mean, that's one of the stupidest things that I think they could do. If you do it, you've got to go with somebody who isn't established, or even somebody we've never seen before. But it's all a moot point anyway, because, you know, Ryan Satin was the first one I saw to report this. Current plans call for, and this might be a little bit of a spoiler, so warning, but the current plan is for Bray Wyatt himself to portray Sister Abigail at the TLC pay-per-view when he wrestles Finn Balor. He will dress up in some way, to portray Sister Abigail. WWE is not planning to introduce an actual Sister Abigail character. Now, I'll say this much. I don't need 20/20 hindsight to know this about Bray Wyatt. I don't need hindsight to know what a gigantic mistake it was, splitting up the Wyatt family and putting them on separate brands. I said it when they did it, and with time, they've only proven me right. Harper and Rowan haven't even been on TV in months. Bray has just been drowning in mediocrity here on this show. They need to reunite the crew. And maybe add a female to the group who isn't Sister Abigail. Because I don't think it's happening. I think that ship sailed a long time ago. But you reunite the family, find a female, kind of like what Nikki Cross is in Sanity right now in NXT. You find a female to go with that group, so you've got a foursome there. That gives Bray some juice, and it adds another tag team to the Raw brand, because that would shift Harper and Rowan back over to Raw. It gives the Raw brand another tag team. You've got the Hardy Boys out. Jeff's not going to be back probably until next summer from his rotator cuff surgery. So the Hardys are out. The Revival is out. For how much longer, I don't know. At least a couple of months. SmackDown needs tag teams too. But it's not as though Harper and Rowan have actually been on TV, so it doesn't really help nor hurt SmackDown if all of a sudden they pop up on Raw. But they're still going to have to call up one or two new teams soon from NXT. So that's the situation as far as the Abigail stuff goes. Don't get your hopes up if you're planning or hoping to see someone actually playing the role, someone other than Wyatt himself playing the role of Sister Abigail. And I don't think you need that. But I do think Bray works a lot better when he's the evil cult leader leading a group of followers. And if you want to add a female, by all means, I think they should, but don't call her Sister Abigail. As far as the Universal title is concerned, and when we may see it defended next, because there's been talk of Finn Balor, who I just mentioned, maybe getting the next shot. He's been rumored as next in line for a match with Brock Lesnar. We got some news this week. John Cena is out of Survivor Series, and Brock Lesnar is in. That is per the new advertising that came out this week for the pay-per-view. This would be the third straight year that John Cena misses the Survivor Series show. And with Lesnar on the show now, that means we get one more Universal title defense this year before the Royal Rumble. Finn Balor has already gone on TV and said that he wants a shot at the championship that he never lost. Which probably means Sister Abigail is losing again at TLC. At least he should, if Balor is going to be the next in line for a title shot. Then again, we just saw SmackDown with Baron Corbin getting rolled up and pinned by Ty Dillinger, you know, 5 days before wrestling AJ Styles for the U.S. title. So who the fuck knows why they do what they do? But again, if this is the case, I mean, it'd be very easy to see Bray losing again and Balor getting a win, and then you feed Balor to Brock at Survivor Series, and you need one more opponent after that at the Royal Rumble before the big dog gets the belt inevitably at WrestleMania. The Cruiserweight stuff with Enzo Amore at the end of the show I thought was actually real good. That is until the big reveal at the end. Enzo was out there telling the entire Cruiserweight division to go to hell. All you fans who support them, you can also go to hell. He puts, you know, more butts in seats than Lazy Boy, he said about himself. And my back is hurting me from carrying the entire division on my back. I mean, he was popping off these one-liners like they were nothing. The entire division came out. They surrounded the ring like lumberjacks. Again, they couldn't put their hands on Enzo. Remember, they established that the week before. Not allowed to touch Enzo Amore. And Enzo then proceeds to run each one of them down one by one. On the microphone, like he's the Rock out there. All of them except for Tozawa. He said, "I'll spare you, Tozawa, because you said nice things about me on social media." So, President Enzo here. So out came Kurt Angle, who admitted that per the stipulation last week, anybody who touched Enzo would not get a shot at the Cruiserweight title. None of the men surrounding the ring would be challenging Enzo for the championship, because if you remember when they went off the air, and they did show this, they all touched Enzo. They all kicked his ass. But, Kurt said, that does not apply to the newest member of the Cruiserweight division, and out walked Kalisto. Yes, here in the main event spot of this show at 11 o'clock at night, with the fans expecting somebody new, somebody big, out walks Kalisto, who should have been in the division from day one, but boy was that a letdown. Now, Kalisto is where he belongs, and I get what they were trying to do here. They were trying to make this guy out to be a big deal. I mean, I guess you can't fault them for trying, but you had to know that the reaction was going to be what it was. Which was disappointment. And, I don't know, ambivalence might be a good word for it. I think people realize that Kalisto is a good wrestler and everything, but they just find it impossible to care about this guy. He's got a new mask. He's got new music. Now he's on a new brand. They'll use Enzo, I guess, as a vessel to try to get people to care about this guy. It's not a bad plan. It's just everything else they've done with him up to this point has been bad, which is why he got the reaction he got when he first walked out. And the way they set it up, they just had to know. It would be impossible for me to fathom that in that spot at the end of the show, introducing him of all people, they did not anticipate that people just would not give a shit about this guy. You could have taken people from NXT, Hideo Itami, I know he's been a heel lately, but he's not been doing anything. He hasn't even been at the last two sets of TV tapings. I don't know what's going on with him. Frankly, I would not be shocked if 6 months from now he's back in Japan. but it could have been Hideo Itami. It could have been, you know, I've seen people, what about Johnny Gargano? Yeah, you know what? Hey, that would have been a good spot for Johnny Gargano. Absolutely. Especially since Ciampa's not going to be back in NXT for a long time yet. And it would actually be kind of cool if, let's say, Ciampa comes back and he sort of follows Gargano to the main roster. Like, he just won't let this... He has to terrorize this guy. He follows him to the main roster. And, you know, that would be a 205 Live feud I can get behind. I don't know... I'm sure Ciampa is under 205. Maybe he's not. But, yeah, you know what? Absolutely. That would have been a fine idea. And believe me, there would have been a lot of people in that crowd also who were like, who's this guy? Right? Who's this short guy coming out here? Who don't know who Johnny Gargano is, but I think... You know, he's been established enough in NXT where enough people would have, and he is very popular, and people do like the guy. It would have gotten some kind of reaction, at least. And it would have been a genuinely new face to put in that division. And actually, the more I say that out loud, the more I like that, because Enzo is such a naturally hateable person. He just is. He's obnoxious, he's annoying, and it's very easy to hate him, which is why I think this heel thing is working as well as it is so far, and I've warmed up to it. Gargano is on the complete opposite side of the spectrum. What is there to hate about Johnny Gargano? I know he's been a heel before, you know, in Evolve and whatever. He can pull it off, but he's such a likable babyface character in NXT. It's the polar opposite of Enzo. So I actually think a feud between those two, I don't know how good the matches would be. The feud, I think, would be fun. I think if anybody could carry Enzo to what I would consider to be like a really good match, Gargano is one of those people. He could go in there and make Enzo look a lot better in the ring than he really is. I'm actually disappointed they didn't go with somebody like Johnny Gargano. And poor Kalisto. It's like Rey Mysterio coming out of the number 30 spot a few years ago in the Rumble. It wasn't his fault. People were shitting on him because he wasn't Daniel Bryan. Poor Ray comes out there, you know, what'd he ever do wrong? Same with Kalisto, he didn't do anything wrong. And they're going to try, and I hope it works, but it didn't work here on this show.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
I got some spoilers. I mean, it's already been spoiled by WWE, so is it really a spoiler? I don't think it is. But if you are allergic to anything resembling a spoiler, you know what to do. You've been warned. With WWE resurrecting old WCW names like Starrcade, they are finally, after all of these years, bringing back War Games. I did the old Larry and Balky dance of joy when I heard the news. When I did my countdown of the top 15 best matches in WCW history, two of the spots on that list were filled by War Games matches. The Wrestle War 1991 match and the Wrestle War 92 match with Sting Squadron against the Dangerous Alliance, which may have been the best War Games that they ever did. I had a lot of fun going back and watching those matches. So I have a soft spot for War Games. I've always been a fan of the concept. Only this time it will not be on the WWE main roster. It will be in NXT. NXT TakeOver War Games is the official title for the Houston TakeOver show next month. So we are getting War Games in November. We're just not getting it at Survivor Series like I've been pitching for. Really pitching for it since episode 127, which was the show I did where I laid out my whole WWE business plan. If Vince McMahon got hit by a bus and he bequeathed the entire company to me, because of course he would. You know how far back that goes? September of 2010. 7 years ago. That was the first time I ever mentioned the idea of doing War Games at Survivor Series on my show. So here, it will have two rings. Regal confirmed that in the announcement that he made at the tapings this past week. He specifically said, two rings, one cage. I saw the video. Hopefully they do the coin flip and the whole nine yards. That we don't know. The last War Games match that WCW did was way back in 2000. And they called it Russo's Revenge, which I thought you could... That's probably the title of his entire run in WCW. But that's what they called the War Games match, which was on Nitro, by the way, back in 2000. Russo's Revenge. So you can imagine the shit show that that was. It didn't even resemble an actual War Games match. It was that stupid triple-decker cage thing that they used in Ready to Rumble, and they just called it War Games. Here, it will be a triple-threat match. It's not going to be, you know, 5-on-5 or 4-on-4. It's going to be three teams against each... Actually, three teams of three. So 9 guys total. It's going to pit Adam Cole, Kyle O'Reilly, and Bobby Fish against all three members of Sanity, against Roderick Strong and the Authors of Pain. I'm very curious how that team ends up being put together at those tapings. I didn't read all of the taping results, so I'll let it play out on TV over the next several weeks. I'm also surprised to see Adam Cole in this match. I figured they were going to set up Cole and Drew McIntyre right away for the championship, but I guess they're going to hold off on that for a while. People were asking Cody Rhodes online what he thought about the idea, given that he and his wife Brandi seemed upset by the news that Starrcade was being brought back as a gimmick to sell tickets for a house show. And War Games, much like Starrcade, is credited to his dad as one of his ideas. Even though if we're really splitting hairs here, I mean, Dusty took the idea from Mad Max. But here, though, Cody said, "I'm not mad. I was told. Triple H worked for my dad, and then my dad worked for him. They were friends. Care and effort will be placed into it." And, you know, little things like letting Mauro Ranallo mention Lance Russell at the beginning of NXT last week, or bringing back War Games. Like, people have said that Triple H has great respect for old school tradition. And you can see that, I think, it comes across in NXT and a lot of the things that they do. I can only hope that he brings that to the main roster when that time comes that he gets handed the keys to the kingdom. Because I think the main roster will be better off for bringing back some of that. Now, there were other spoilers in terms of matches that they've set up. The women's match now is officially set up. The Fatal 4-Way for TakeOver. Drew McIntyre is going to be defending his championship. It will not be against Adam Cole. There is another challenger. I'm not going to get into that. I'll let that... You can go online and read if you can't wait and you must know. But I'll let that play out on TV over the weeks. But the as you might imagine, I was very excited to hear about that War Games announcement. And all of a sudden, that weekend, here we go again, where NXT is already overshadowing Survivor Series. It's overshadowing the big Raw and SmackDown pay-per-view of that weekend. Without even knowing the Survivor Series card, I'm already looking at this going, this is going to be the better show. This seems to be a recurring pattern here anytime NXT runs the same weekend as one of these pay-per-views. I thought NXT this week was a good show and had a really good main event for the NXT Championship with Drew McIntyre and Roderick Strong. Nikki Cross came out yet again mid-match to help Ruby Riott in what had been a handicap match against the iconic duo Billie Kay and Peyton Royce. This was a carbon copy of what they did a few weeks ago. Ruby got the win for her team with a Pele kick to Billie. It's not like they have a set of women's tag team titles, so I'm not exactly sure where this is going. But I am intrigued, I guess. Lio Rush made his NXT debut. He came out for a match with Aleister Black that never got started, as Lio was attacked by the Velveteen Dream before Black got to the ring. He should be thanking him, frankly, for the attack, because he saved him from what would have been a guaranteed loss here in his debut. Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish, they were not spared. Lio Rush was. Aleister Black, I mean, at this point, this guy should rename his finish the Honor Killing, because he has become the ROH Killer here in NXT. Whenever these Ring of Honor guys come in, they get fed to him in their first match. So, Velveteen Dream, he comes out of the crowd. I think he was wearing a mask. He comes out of the crowd. He attacks Lio Rush. Aleister Black stops in the aisleway. He's just standing there watching this. And the Velveteen Dream goes up to the top rope. He starts swiveling his hips like he's ravishing Rick Rude. And he comes off the top rope and gives Lio the Purple Rainmaker elbow drop. Kairi Sane has some competition now for the best looking elbow drop in all of wrestling. This guy got some height on that thing. He looked like he was in another stratosphere before he came down. He could have been literally, if he wanted to, if he reached up, hanging from the rafters. That's how high up he was. I tweeted a screenshot. As I'm watching NXT on my phone, I see this and I'm like, holy shit. And I tweet out a screenshot of him in mid-flight. And you look at that and it could be photoshopped. You would never even know it was real. So Dream wanted Aleister Black to come on in. Aleister came down. As soon as Aleister Black got in the ring, though, Dream bailed. So Aleister's in the ring. He's just sitting there looking directly ahead, I guess, towards the hard camera. He's sitting Indian style with his legs crossed in the ring, never making eye contact with Patrick Clark. He's getting very frustrated outside the ring. "Look at me," he kept screaming. "Say my name, say my name. I'm going to get you to say my name." And this is a feud, you know, on paper that I figured I would have absolutely no interest in. And yet I find myself liking what they've been doing with these two guys so far. And you know, the story is, to what lengths will the Velveteen Dream go to get this man to say his name? You know, we'll have to wait to find out. But I've been impressed by what I've seen so far from Patrick Clark. You know, he was one of the few guys who actually had ring experience when he was on Tough Enough. He was already a wrestler. He wrestled independently. Him and Leo Rush were tag team partners for a while up in the New England area. So he didn't come into this, you know, completely inexperienced and green. He was already a wrestler. They signed him. He's been down there for a while now. I guess he has found his character, and he's put everything into it. And I think he could be a name. I really do. I think he could be, you know, a solid player on the main roster at some point. And I think he could be a solid player here in NXT. He's another example, and we've had a few of these. And I think Roderick Strong is another one. There are just some guys, and Tyler Breeze was another. There are just some guys who you look at and either you don't see them as NXT champion, or there's already too many guys vying for the championship on top, and so you have in the middle a handful, a collection of guys who have nothing to do. And I do think that it's long past time to have some sort of secondary championship in NXT. I was kind of hoping they would introduce one, call it the Dream title or something, after Dusty passed away and they went with a Dusty tournament idea instead. You don't have to call it the Dream title. You can call it whatever you want. But I do think there are certain guys, and you know, Clark would be one of them, who could easily be, you know, competing for a singles title, a secondary title on that show, you know, to give them something to fight over. Speaking of Kairi Sane, she was out next for a match against Aaliyah. I don't know about positioning the two elbows back-to-back in segments like this, but she did hit the insane elbow for the win. If this were Lucha Underground, I would say put them in a match against each other. We could have Kairi Sane against the Velveteen Dream. First person to hit their elbow wins the match. Actually, given the nature of his character and how he sort of acts and everything, I don't know. There's something. I mean, you guys know I'm not a big fan of the intergender stuff in Lucha Underground. It's just a turnoff for me when they do the singles matches. I don't mind it so much when they have the women, you know, as part of like a tag team match or a six-person tag, and then they get in there and they, you know, hang with the guys for a few minutes. But when it's like one-on-one and they're, you know, kicking the crap out of them, and I'm not a fan of it. But I might be willing to make an exception here in this case, just because I think it would make for an interesting match. Kairi Sane actually did wrestle in Lucha Underground. She was Doku when they did that one episode. It was an entire episode. It was nothing except a gauntlet match where Pentagon Jr., or maybe he was Pentagon Dark at the time, I don't know, but Pentagon had to run through the Black Lotus Triad, and that was the entire episode. He had basically three individual matches with the three women who were part of this faction. And she hit the elbow on that episode on Pentagon. But then he broke her arm. So, see, just proves my point. You can't be doing the intergender stuff. Poor Kairi had her arm broken. We had Drew McIntyre and Roderick Strong for the NXT Championship. Strong dropped McIntyre across the ring steps at one point with a backbreaker. The faces of the fans in the front row when he did that were priceless. They had a real solid match here. Strong gave him a tiger driver for a near fall, three knees and a sick kick for another near fall. Outside the ring, Drew gave him basically a buckle bomb into the ring post, which looked like it sucked. Sucked for Roddy anyway. Rolled him inside, hit the Future Shock DDT, which used to be his finish at one point. Now it's just a setup move for the Claymore kick, which he hit for the win. They shook hands after the match. I thought for sure we were about to get a Bob Backlund turn with Roddy slapping the shit out of him and then turning heel, but we didn't. Instead, Roddy was confronted up on stage as he was leaving by Cole, Fish, and O'Reilly. And they patted him on the back, and Adam Cole said a few words to him that I couldn't hear. And that left Drew McIntyre in the ring looking very confused and very suspicious of Roderick Strong. Now, I thought that's how they would debut. I thought back at the Brooklyn Takeover in August that, you know, Roddy would be out there with the other three and they would all be attacking Drew McIntyre. Or maybe they would be attacking McIntyre and Bobby Roode, just beating them both up. And they would, you know, be like the ROH foursome. And it looks like that could still happen, although based on the teams and the War Games match, I suspect that obviously this is just a swerve and nothing more. But that was NXT. Solid episode this week, and obviously I'm very excited to see how the build-up goes to War Games. People have been asking me, oh, so does this mean you're going to come out to Houston now? No, no. I'm saving up for New Orleans next year. But and also, you look, I'm looking forward to Mauro Ranallo calling his first War Games match. I think that that's going to be a lot of fun. So I'm perfectly content to stay home and watch it. Good on them. Good on them, even if it is just to make a few bucks off all the old WCW trademarks, you know, bringing back all the old names, whatever their reasoning is. It took Triple H in NXT to give us War Games, since Vince McMahon obviously never was going to do that. And so I am thankful that we are getting it in some form. Lucha Underground. This was week two of Ultima Lucha. And before I get into the show from this past week, the update on the status of Lucha Underground, according to this week's Observer, is that a decision will not be made for another month or so, but there is a better than 50% chance that it does come back for a season four, but with a much more scaled down budget. El Rey has to make a decision very soon or else they lose the rights to the show and then the producers can shop it around to other networks. So we're either getting a cheaper budget version of Lucha Underground or the show is dead. Not very encouraging either way. So if we do only have two episodes left before the end, if this is the end, I'm going to enjoy the hell out of them as I did this week's show. This week's show is all about the ladies with Katrina, Ivelisse, Mariposa, Melissa Santos, all playing a key role. This was Ultima Lucha 3, Night 2, which opened with Jeremiah Crane. This was a backstage segment. He was telling Ivelisse, I'm not in love with you anymore. Remember, he was introduced as Ivelisse's new boyfriend. And we have seen segments with him and Katrina. Clearly, there's a relationship between them that goes back many years. He's still infatuated with her. And so here he just flat out admits, look, I'm not in love with you anymore. I'm in love with Katrina. Hey, motherfucker, so am I. Back off. So now, Katrina is her opponent here on this episode. And that doesn't make Ivelisse very happy. And she says, you know what, I don't even need you. And she goes to leave, and he calls her a bitch. You don't do that to Ivelisse. Ivelisse turns around, she super kicks him through the door of one of the bathroom stalls. So that's how the segment ends, with Jeremiah Crane laying knocked out in the shitter. We had a battle royal for one of Dario Cueto's unique opportunities with the White Rabbit Tribe, the Mac, PJ Black, Ricky Mundo, Arjenis, Cortez Castro, Joey Ryan, Vinny Massaro, Son of Madness, Masquerita Sagrada, and the returning Pimpinella Escarlata. I've missed seeing Pimpinella Escarlata. It's a lot of fun when they're out there. This did not even last 5 minutes. Mac won by giving PJ Black a stunner, tossing him out. Dario came out of his office after Mac got the win, and he says, Mac, you have won a unique opportunity, and your unique opportunity is a shot at the trio's titles next week at Ultima Lucha against the Reptile Tribe. But the catch is that his partners will be two guys who destroyed each other last week, Killshot and Dante Fox. So, yes, 2 weeks... It'll be 2 weeks, right? After the match we saw where Dante Fox was almost literally killed in storyline. Now he's back in action. Just like that. I think that's kind of nutty myself to have him back so quickly, but there you have it. The biggest thing I'm going to miss about this show, if it ends, is Dario Cueto. I think lost in all this hoopla about whether Lucha Underground's coming back or not, and even if it does come back, you know, if they have to cut budget and they can't bring everybody back, Dario may not be back. I mean, who knows? I would think they would make him a priority, but we don't know that. Maybe they wouldn't be able to pay him as much, and he says adios. And that's sort of been lost in all this, is that we could very well only have, you know, two shows left of what has become probably my favorite character in all of wrestling on any wrestling show. He is the best authority figure in all of wrestling, and I am sick to death of authority figures in wrestling. And I would say that, you know what, hopefully maybe he got bit by the wrestling bug, and because he does some other acting stuff. We've seen him do, you know, pop up on TV shows and commercials, and so he has other things that he does. They just brought him in for this show. We can hope he got bit by the wrestling bug and enjoyed it, and maybe he gets picked up to be on another wrestling show, but there's no other wrestling show that looks the way Lucha Underground looks. The way they shoot all of his scenes here on their show, it would not be the same, I think, if he went somewhere else. Katrina against Ivelisse. Oh, be still my heart. If you were looking for a great sort of technical women's wrestling match, hold for hold, that's not what this was. This was a fight, and a damn good one. Katrina hits the ring first. She has Mil Muertes out there with her. Mil's in a suit, like her manager, even though he disappeared once the match started. But this is like one of those memes that you see online where people take Paul Heyman's face, and they put it on Brock Lesnar's body, and they put Brock in a suit, right? This was a complete role reversal here from what we're used to seeing. Normally, it's Katrina in the corner with the Rock, and Mil is the wrestler in the ring. Or with the stone, I should say, not the Rock. And here, Katrina is in the ring, and she's ready to go to war. And there's Mil outside in a suit. So it was very weird. Katrina gets on the mic. She says, come out, wherever you are, bitch. And Ivelisse comes sprinting out. You knew that shit was about to go down when you see her sprinting to the ring like that. They brawl around outside. They start chopping the shit out of each other. Katrina locks herself inside Dario's office. So Ivelisse can't get in. Now, I did wonder as I'm watching this, you know, as she's running away from Ivelisse, you know, we've seen Katrina teleport many, many times before. Is she not allowed to use her teleportation powers once the bell rings? I guess not. Ivelisse eventually breaks into the office, but Katrina smashes a glass bottle over her head. Then she shatters two more bottles over her head, and Ivelisse is bleeding like crazy. Katrina gives Ivelisse a kiss, comes up with blood, Ivelisse's blood all over her mouth. This was, I don't know, man. I don't know. I was enjoying myself watching this match. They're in the crowd now. Evie is covered in blood. She starts ramming Katrina face first over and over again onto a chair. Finally, they make their way back into the ring. Katrina hits her with her own version of the Reaper's Trident, or as most people would call it, a spear. Katrina grabs the stone that we always see her carrying to the ring for Mills matches, and goes to use it, but Evie cuts her off, gives her a spine buster for a near fall. Ivelisse then grabs the stone. She goes to use it. Katrina cuts her off. Now they're fighting over it. They're fighting over the stone. I thought it was going to go flying into the crowd or something, but Ivelisse wins the tug of war. She whacks Katrina with it, hits a DDT, and gets the pin. Ivelisse looked like a badass bitch when this was over, with blood all over her face. Jeremiah Crane then comes out post-match and whacks Ivelisse right in the ankle with a hammer. That same ankle that's been broken before. In fact, I think she's had two broken ankles before. That's why she's missed so much time here on this show. He drags her across the ring and hits her again in the ankle with the hammer. Katrina slides in to retrieve the stone. I really like this match. It wasn't a masterpiece or anything. It wasn't even that long. It was maybe 5 or 6 minutes, but it was hot from start to finish. Crowd was hot for the whole thing. It was exactly the kind of brawl it needed to be given how long this has been built up for. Main event was a mask versus hair match between Phoenix and Marty the Moth Martinez. The disgust with which Melissa Santos always announces Marty's name is just fantastic. Early on, Phoenix did a dive out to the floor, and Marty pulled his sister Mariposa into harm's way to take the hit. After that, Mariposa said, "Fuck you." She flipped off her brother and walked to the back. Marty started tearing the mask off of Phoenix's face. And I don't mean like, oh, he's kind of ripping and tearing at it. He basically ripped the entire mask in half. Like, By the time he was done ripping at it, you could see Phoenix's face. He was basically unmasked in this match, which sort of killed the stip. Phoenix gets slammed face first into the exposed buckle in the corner. He does the mother of all blade jobs, okay? He is bleeding like a stuck pig, leaking all over the place. This was exactly what happened in that first Grave Consequences match with Mil Muertes, where he ripped his mask off like half away, and Phoenix was bleeding all over the place. Here, you could see him leaking blood like a faucet. And there were a lot of cool moves here. Phoenix hit a lethal injection at one point for a near fall. He hit a Spanish fly off the top rope for another near fall. Marty hit a curb stomp. He then goes in the corner. He grabs a lunchbox that he brought to the ring with him. I would have popped huge if he would have pulled out a sandwich and just sat in the corner and started literally eating lunch in the middle of this bloodbath. Instead, he pulls out a pair of scissors. He starts digging the pointy edge of the scissors into Phoenix's bloody forehead. He teases trying to dig out his eyeball with it when Melissa has seen enough. She can't take it anymore. She takes her shoes off. She jumps up onto the apron. She's screaming. She's jumping up and down, begging Marty to stop. She says, "I'll run away with you. I love you. I'll run away with you." And Marty drops the scissors. He pulls her into the ring. Melissa slaps him. Then she kicks him in the dick. She's been studying her Undertaker tapes. Phoenix then gets the win with a 450 off the top. Melissa dogpiles on top of Phoenix to cover Marty for the three count. Melissa then is kissing Phoenix when the match is over. Now she has blood all over her face. A lot of blood was spilled, I have to say, so far in these first two episodes of Ultima Lucha, okay? About 10 pints of blood alone, I think, was spilled in that Hell of War match last week. And now this week, it's Ivelisse and Phoenix. With the loss, Marty is supposed to get a haircut, but he bails out of the ring. Mariposa appears at the top of the staircase, and she's summoning her brother. I guess she has forgiven him. Or has she? In the ring, Melissa is yelling at Marty, "Where are you going? Don't be a pussy, don't be a pussy." And when Marty gets to the top of the stairs, Mariposa nails him with a chair shot to the head. He goes tumbling down the steps about halfway. She then handcuffs his arms, each of his arms, to the banister on either side, and hands the cutting instruments to Melissa Santos, who begins cutting Marty's hair. Phoenix grabs the hair trimmer. He begins shearing off the rest of his locks. They did about half a job on him. He looked ridiculous when it was over. And that's how they went off the air. A satisfying payoff to a love story that's been playing out all season long. And a happy way to end the show. It's like a Disney story, only with blood. One last Lucha note from this week's Observer. There is a casting call out for later this month for a TV pilot for a show that is said to be similar to Raw and SmackDown, but with elements of Lucha Libre. Yeah, it's called 205 Live. I guess the idea here is actually the ones behind the show is Arilux, and if that name sounds familiar, that's the company I think that the DOA guys, Ron and Don Harris, are behind. They were sort of keeping things afloat for a while with Impact. We can get into the whole sordid story of what was going on with Impact and Arilux and Anthem, and I don't want to even think about that. But the idea here is that they think Lucha Underground, good concept in theory, poor execution, because it was aimed at English speakers. Whereas this, I guess, would be a Lucha Libre product that they would turn around and try to sell to a Spanish language station sometime next year, at which point, if it were to get picked up, they would form an actual promotion around it, they would do house shows. We've heard this song and dance before, right? I mean, lots of different shows and companies, "Oh, we have all these big plans, we're going to do this, we're going to go on the road," and then nothing ever happens. I'm still waiting to find out about that, the all-women's league. Remember that again? All the wrestling daughters were going to be behind. Apparently, according to Lacey Von Erich, it's a big secret. It's been a big secret for over a year now. At some point, you got to tell people the secret. So that's the idea behind this. That's the aspirations they have for this, right? They're looking for experienced actors, wrestlers. Here's the kicker, and here's why I even mentioned this. They are said to be interested in hiring Vince Russo as a writer. I swear this guy is like a rash. Just when you think it's all cleared up, there it is again. They want Russo, with the idea being that Chris DeJoseph, who's the head writer for Lucha Underground, he knew nothing about Lucha Libre coming in, And he ended up having success in writing Lucha Underground, whatever your definition of success is. So they want somebody like that. Yes, because when I think of who would be a good person to write a Lucha Libre show geared not to the American audience, but to the Spanish-speaking audience, I think of Vince Russo. So that whole project is already off to a fantastic start. Get to the mailbag. You can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in as we dive into the mailbag here and we pull one out from James from New York City. Being that Enzo Amore is a heel now, would WWE consider putting him and Big Cass back together again? I feel their tag team run was far too short, especially for fans who don't watch NXT. Yeah, well, I mean, they never should have split them up in the first place. That was stupid. They were only together about a year on the main roster before they pulled the plug. So they should be reunited, but not as a tag team. I think what they have Enzo doing now is fine. The time that it takes for Cass to get, you know, fully healed up from his injury, it'll be many, many more months. By then, I think Enzo will have had, you know, he I say run through. But he probably will have run through most of the guys in the cruiserweight division. I think at some point there has to be a payoff where somebody takes the title off him, maybe around WrestleMania time. So at that point, you've done all you can do with Enzo and the cruiserweight stuff. Now Big Cass comes back. I say put the two of them back together, but with Enzo managing Cass, which I think is what they should have done in the first place. I think they should have taken Enzo out of the ring. His money is in his mouth. And I think you make him the mouthpiece for Big Cass. They could still do that. They could. And now they're both heels. You're absolutely right. So if they bring Cass back as a heel, there you go. You reunite them. Enzo can be his representative. Takes him out of the ring. It's a win-win situation. Steve from Virginia. Since Brock Lesnar will likely hold the Universal title until WrestleMania, what should the Raw brand use the Elimination Chamber for in the pay-per-view before WrestleMania? That is, if the Raw brand has the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view next year. Yeah, I don't know what brand has the chamber next year. I don't know if it's Raw or SmackDown. It would make sense for it to be Raw. Here's why it would make sense. People have asked me, oh, does Roman Reigns challenging Brock for the championship mean that we're in for another Royal Rumble win for Roman Reigns? No, I don't think we are. Because you can have somebody from SmackDown win the Royal Rumble, and then Roman Reigns can challenge Brock. He can earn that shot in some other way. I think, so for me, especially if you put the title on Nakamura, AJ Styles, I would have him win the Royal Rumble. Go on to challenge Nakamura for the championship at WrestleMania. In the meantime, if Raw has the chamber in February, you have an Elimination Chamber match, and Roman Reigns wins the Elimination Chamber. And that's how you determine a number one contender for the Universal title. So, to me, that's what makes the most sense. Daryl from Los Angeles. Both Brock Lesnar and Jon Jones are coming off convincing UFC wins followed by failed USADA drug tests. With Jon calling out Brock following his last win, if you're WWE, why not scrap Brock versus Roman for Lesnar versus Jon Jones in a work-shoot MMA match in the main event of WrestleMania? You could even bump the Roman feud up to the Rumble and have Jon debut in the Rumble match. That's quite the idea. You're assuming that Jon Jones would even contractually be able to do everything you just said. The answer is no, he's not. He's under contract to UFC. I don't like the idea. Look, I'm not saying that it wouldn't be a big fight and they can't like make money off it and all that. I don't like Jon Jones. I don't like him. I don't think it sends a good message to sort of reward him by giving him, paying him God knows how much money for one match. I don't like it. Just me personally, I just don't like the idea, and it's never going to happen that this plan that Vince McMahon has been working towards for years now, the crowning of Roman Reigns, slaying the beast at WrestleMania. Oh, I know. Let's bump Roman off WrestleMania and put Jon Jones, a non-wrestler, in the main event against Brock Lesnar. There's not a chance in hell that Vince McMahon is going to do that. Let alone derail whatever his plans are for Roman Reigns. I mean, Roman, hey, he's said it himself when he plays it up in his own promos, right? I've main evented the last 4, soon to be 5 WrestleManias or something like that. He's been in the main event of WrestleMania now going back to 31. 34 ain't going to be no different. Shamar from Avondale, Arizona. I've been watching Raw replays on the network and got to Raw 200, which features the great debate between Paul Heyman and Jerry Lawler. The debate seemed to get heated between the two. Was the segment a shoot or a work? And why would Vince even have a different promotion on WWE television? Well, when you're losing a wrestling war, it makes you do funny things. You tend to be more open to things like working with other promotions. There was a working agreement that a lot of people didn't know about for a few years there between WWE and ECW. And WWE would even send guys that they weren't really using to ECW. They did that with, Enzo. Not Enzo. They did that with, oh my God, can you imagine Enzo in the old ECW? I actually think he would do well there. I mean, he would get absolutely killed, but I think he would do well. But they sent Aldo Montoya, who became Just Incredible. They sent Al Snow there. It was in ECW that Al Snow started the head gimmick, and then when he got hot, WWE took him back. So clearly there was a working relationship there, a talent agreement between the two promotions. It came out later on with the bankruptcy and everything that Vince was basically sort of bankrolling ECW in many ways, and ECW owed him a whole bunch of money to the tune, I think, of something like $500,000. So When you're in a war with another company, if let's say WWE was winning the wrestling war, if they had the bigger ratings, if they were making money hand over fist, they would have no reason at all to work with Paul Heyman. It would have been Eric Bischoff working with Paul Heyman and the two of them dumping on Vince McMahon. So that's why that was going on. As far as the great debate, that's one of my favorite segments from Raw. I remember that. I remember the giant WWF logo right on the front of the podium. I remember Lawler at the end of the segment calling out his friends. Oh, I got my friends too. And he's calling out guys from the back from WWF, and nobody came out to help him because nobody liked him. Work, shoot, it was a little bit of both, right? I mean, they had Paul Heyman out there, and there's no way that this could have been, you know, scripted into the show. They had Heyman out there making cracks about Lawler liking young underage girls, like hanging out at the playground and all that kind of stuff, right? So yeah, I'm sure that they went out there and they had the freedom to make this intense and make it look real and feel real and sound real. And those are two of the best guys to do it. Those are two of the best mic guys that you'll ever find, Jerry Lawler and Paul Heyman. So yeah, the whole thing was, it was a worked situation. But in terms of some of the one-liners and some of the insults, yeah, I mean, they hit a little too close to home. They took the handcuffs off and let them go out there and do their thing. And it made for great TV. It still didn't win them the ratings. WCW at that point was just a monster. But it made for great TV. Let's see here. We have Phil from Long Island. What did you think of the idea of the WWE champion bouncing back and forth between Raw and SmackDown during the original brand split? And do you think it would be better or worse if WWE decided to do that again today? I was a fan of it back then. They did that at the very beginning. Actually, it was only about a month, right? Maybe it wasn't even a month. They introduced that World Heavyweight title pretty quickly, so I guess they really didn't do it, did they? But Brock was the undisputed champion. And, you know, in theory, he would have been the one bouncing back and forth between the two shows. I liked that idea. And I thought that it made that champion feel even more special. It gave them more opponents to work with. When let's say he was in a feud with somebody on SmackDown and Raw was going to be without the belt for a month or two, you could have elevated the secondary titles. You could have, or just had feuds that were not based around a championship. I mean, we see that on SmackDown now with Shane McMahon and Kevin Owens. Every now and then you get these personal feuds that have nothing to do with titles, but they can sort of carry the brand on their own. I like the idea. Now, you know, would it be better or worse if they went and did that now? I think it would be worse. I mean, my God, look at who they have as the champions. If Brock Lesnar was the champion, now he's dividing his time between two brands. Now we have two shows that have no champion on it most of the year. That would be awful. And on the other hand, you have Jinder Mahal as the WWE champion. I don't want to see Jinder Mahal bouncing back and forth between Raw and SmackDown, beating everybody. That's ridiculous. And if they were doing that, Jinder wouldn't even be the champion. The only reason he is the champion is because SmackDown has its own title, and they can put the other belt on, on somebody like Brock Lesnar, who's far more believable as the champion when he actually decides to show up. So as things stand now with who they have those titles on, that would be a terrible idea. But in theory, I like the idea of having one champion who bounces back and forth between the two shows instead of having two world titles. I mean, look at the WWE title. I just talked about this a few weeks ago. The WWE title right now is as valuable as the WCW television title. And I said that title's been dead for 17 years. Another pay-per-view coming up tonight, where the WWE title does not even headline the show. Doesn't even feel like the main event. Because it's lost a lot of luster. You know, with Jinder as the champion, this was bound to happen. The focus is not so much on Jinder, it's on someone else. It's like one of those old Chris Jericho title runs that he had back in the early 2000s, where, yeah, he's the champ, but is he really the central focus of the show? No, not really. That was the NWO. And when CM Punk had the championship, now eventually when he turned heel and, you know, hooked up with Paul Heyman, he became a bigger deal, it felt like. But when he won the championship from Del Rio at Survivor Series, he wasn't in the main event. John Cena and The Rock were in the main event. WrestleMania, it wasn't CM Punk in the main event defending the title. He was defending it second from the top. Who was in the main event? John Cena and The Rock. CM Punk defends the championship against Daniel Bryan. Was that a main event on any of those shows? Of course not. And that's sort of the type of reign that we now have with Jinder Mahal. We go through these phases where they put the title on somebody and then they don't put, you know, all their muscle behind them. They don't see them as, being worthy, I guess, of carrying main events on their own. And to be perfectly honest with you, they're not wrong. I am not blaming WWE for that. I could blame them for putting the belt on him in the first place. But, you know, the main events that we've seen Jinder have on pay-per-view have been atrocious. The Punjabi prison match was garbage. The matches with Randy Orton were not that good. So thank God we have Shane McMahon and Kevin Owens in the main event in a Hell in a Cell match on this show. Because if they took Nakamura and Jinder Mahal, especially not being inside the cell, and put those two in the main event, that thing would die a death. I mean, I like Nakamura, but I have no interest in that match whatsoever. Steve from Brooklyn. Buy or sell on the bigger triple threat match that never happened? Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels versus The Undertaker in 1997? Or Steve Austin versus the Triple H versus The Rock anytime in 1999 to 2002? I'm going to buy on Austin, Rock, and Triple H. We almost got it. I mean, that was the match that was set for Survivor Series in 99, and then Austin, unfortunately, was struck down by a car. Who could have seen that coming, right? I mean, he certainly didn't. But no, I mean, that was a big triple threat match that I'm, looking back, kind of surprised we never did get. You know, we never did get Austin against Rock against Triple H, unless there was some house show, live event type deal that I'm not aware of, where the match did happen. I literally don't think the match ever took place. And Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, and Undertaker would have been a good match too, especially in 97. They all had issues with each other. But I think Austin, Rock, and Triple H, I mean, you're talking 99, 2000, right? At the peak of their popularity and the popularity of that company, that would have been a huge match. Rodarius from Alexander City, Alabama. Other than Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, who would you say was the best and the worst member of the Four Horsemen over the years? Aside from Flair and Arn, the person I think of the most is Tully Blanchard. So I got to go with Tully as the best horseman after those two. So that's pretty easy. As far as the worst, it comes down to two people and it's tough. It's either Paul Roma or Mongo McMichael. I know Mongo was at least popular at one point, and he actually turned into a decent wrestler. I thought he did anyway. But as a horseman, I gotta go with Mongo as being the worst. You know, Paul Roma was a bad choice. Didn't last very long. But that was never intended to be his spot. That was supposed to be Tully's spot because they were going to reunite the Horsemen in 93, and then he got popped for cocaine or whatever it was, and his career basically was over at that point. I got to go with Mongo. This is the same man who, for the first 8 months or so of Monday Nitro, did commentary with his pet chihuahua sitting in his lap. Okay, if it was a Doberman or something, I'd say maybe, but a chihuahua, I mean, come on, that's not a horseman. I mean, a bulldog or something, maybe, but a chihuahua, come on, that's not horseman material right there. Isaac from London, Ontario. I went back and watched some old Raw episodes from 1993, and more specifically, the one where Razor Ramon won the Battle Royal to become the Intercontinental Champion. I know this happened because of Shawn Michaels being stripped of the belt that fall, but I heard rumors that he actually quit the company shortly after. Is there any truth to this? And if so, what was the reason? No, I mean, he didn't quit the company. He got suspended for a failed drug test. And I don't know how he addressed that in his book. I did not read his book, but that's what happened. And so, yeah, they came up with some cockamamie reason on TV. You know, the 30-day rule. He didn't defend the championship in time, so they were stripping him of it. And I think he actually legitimately held on to the belt, and they had to make a new one. I don't know if he was holding it hostage or what, but I know he was not a happy camper, and, you know, he would not be happy about being, you know, suspended for that. And then they brought him back a few months later. I think they brought him back early because of what happened with Jerry Lawler. He was dealing with some legal issues, and all of a sudden, Shawn Michaels is back at Survivor Series, teaming with a bunch of guys dressed up as Royal Knights from medieval times. So that's what happened. He didn't quit. He got suspended. He failed the drug test. Dylan from Toronto. WWE recently put out a few Kane-related videos in honor of his 20-year debut. I forgot just how many tag teams he was part of, other than the infamous Brothers of Destruction. Mankind, Big Show, X-Pac, The Hurricane, RVD, Daniel Bryan. In your opinion, which Kane tag team would you buy on, excluding the Brothers of Destruction? And with this many successful tag teams, is Kane the ultimate tag team specialist? I'm a Kane and X-Pac guy. That I've always been a fan of that team. I always liked those two as a tag team. And the time when, you know, X-Pac ripped the voice box away and said, "No, you don't need this thing anymore. You're gonna speak. You're gonna say your first words." And that's when Kane said, "Suck it," and everybody popped. But I've always been a fan of that tag team, and I couldn't even tell you why. I think they held the belts a couple of times. So I'd go with Kane and X-Pac. I would rank them second after Undertaker and Kane, and probably Kane and Bryan I'd probably put third. That was more of a comedy duo than a serious one. As far as tag team specialists go, he'd be up there. He would definitely be up there. I would put Cesaro up there as well. I mean, look at all the teams that that guy's been part of, right? Going back to the Kings of Wrestling days with Chris Hero and Ring of Honor. In WWE, him and Tyson Kidd were a great team. He and Jack Swagger turned into a real good team before they split them up. And now he and Sheamus, they have found success and cranked out some pretty great matches with the Hardy Boys and the Shield. So I would put Cesaro in that same category, and I'll give you one more. I would put Arn Anderson on that list. Arn was part of a few different tag teams, going back to him and Ole, and then him and Tully. And then there were, I think there were at least two more after that he was part of. And he always excelled in that role. I mean, he had a run as like TV champion for a while in WCW that people, I think, remember pretty fondly. But I always saw him, honestly, as more of a tag team guy. I never really saw Arn Anderson standing alone as, you know, the top heel or anything like that. He was a tag team guy, and he just worked, I think, in that role. He was a great tag team wrestler. Mike from Illinois. A few months ago, I was listening to Stone Cold's podcast. He was interviewing a wrestler from the rock and wrestling era. I think it was Jake the Snake, and they both remarked that Andre the Giant would stiff you in the ring if he didn't like you, and he was so big in there, there was nothing you could do about it. There's this general mysticism about Andre being strong beyond his size, but King Kong Bundy flat out said in an interview that the bigger guys could have physically dominated Andre in a fight. Bundy said this is in reference to Andre's ego and the way people were afraid of him, implying that it was actually his extremely protected status in WWE that kept anybody from crossing him. What do you think? For the largest wrestlers of that era, would pissing off Andre be a physical threat or more of a financial one? I think both. I would think both. I mean, he could hurt you, and then you'd have a lot of medical bills to pay. So yeah, it would be a financial liability, I would think, to piss off somebody who was that big. There are things about Andre that are exaggerated. I don't want to shit on Andre, but like, there's so much about him, I think, that's exaggerated. His size being the main thing. Like, obviously, he was a gigantic man. The whole 7'4", 7'5" thing is just a complete joke. I don't even think Andre was a legitimate 7 feet. Even in his prime, before he, you know, he had the back problems and he started to shrink a little bit and had the back surgery and all that. I mean, if you took Andre and Undertaker and stood them side by side, I doubt there would honestly be much of a difference between the two of them. And Taker is what, 6'9"? Like 6'10"? I mean, they'd have Andre standing on boxes for some of his interviews just to make him look taller than he actually was. Now, Bundy worked with him, so he would know better than we would if the guy was legitimately tough or if he was, you know, it was more a case of people thinking he was tough and not wanting to get into trouble for messing around with him. I'll tell you this much, I sure as hell wouldn't have wanted to piss that guy off, right? There are stories of Andre not liking certain people. Like Randy Savage. He did not like Randy Savage. I know he didn't like Big John Studd. There's an infamous match he had with the Iron Sheik, which is on YouTube if you want to watch it, where he also apparently did not like the Iron Sheik. I think he felt Sheik took advantage of jobbers and people in the ring, which is kind of funny, being that we're talking about Andre taking liberties with people in the ring. Whatever his beef was with the Sheik, he didn't like the Sheik. And there's a match online where he is not cooperating very much with Sheik and stiffing the hell out of him and laying on him. And it's a struggle. I mean, it's a tough night at the office on that particular night for the Iron Sheik. I don't know if it was maybe payback for something or what the story was behind it, but it was very obvious there that he was not fond of the Sheik. So he could make your life a living hell in the ring if he didn't like you. I would not want to piss off anybody who could just sit on me and crush me. I'm sure he was one of Vince's protected guys. Andre was an attraction. And you don't want somebody making your attraction look bad, right? Or exposing him. So especially if you had Andre in the ring, let's say, with a smaller wrestler. Smaller does not mean that they're not tough. There's a lot of small guys who can beat the piss out of guys that are twice their size. It's the whole elephant and the mouse story, right? Elephants are gigantic. If they see a mouse, they freak out and they run away, kind of like me. So you can't judge somebody just because they're small. You're making a mistake, I think, by doing that. Boy, would that have exposed Andre if he took liberties in the ring one night with somebody who was 6'4", and they turned around and beat the crap out of him. So you had to protect your attraction. He obviously had some pull. There's the classic story of the Freebirds and their very short sort of blink if you missed it, or blink and you missed it stint in WWE in the mid-80s. I think they were only there for maybe a couple of weeks, like literally 2 weeks I think they were there for. Freebirds were being the Freebirds. They were showing up late. They were drunk. And then one night, Andre, I think the story was Andre might have been the agent that night. He didn't like that. He felt they were being unprofessional. He said they were fired. They said, well, you don't have the authority to do that. And Andre said, okay, we'll see. And, well, that was the end of the Freebirds in WWE. Well, that's the version of the story that Bret Hart tells anyway. Everybody has their own version of how that went down. Michael Hayes has his version of what went down. But I think that's the version that Bret Hart tells in his book. Remington from Houston, buy or sell on the WrestleMania 34 match involving Triple H that you would most like to see? Triple H against Kevin Owens or Triple H against Shane McMahon? I'm buying on Triple H against Shane McMahon. I'm selling on Triple H and Owens. I'm at a point now with Triple H where, much as I like a lot of the stuff he's doing in NXT, I have no interest in seeing Triple H wrestle at WrestleMania, you know, building up the next Triple H match against somebody on the roster. I just don't have any interest in it. I know he keeps himself in good shape. He can still wrestle. I mean, he's a lot older now, and he's not the Triple H he was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. It's hard to bring myself to a point where I can care about building up a big Triple H match at WrestleMania. except for Shane McMahon. And you guys know that I've wanted to see that match. I would love to see a Triple H Shane McMahon match at WrestleMania, more for the build-up to the match itself. You know, we were talking a little while ago. Somebody asked me about the Great Debate segment on Raw back in 97 between Paul Heyman and Jerry Lawler. Was it a work? Was it a shoot? There were elements of both. I don't need to know. Let me go back and see the papers from that night. No, I watched it on TV. Clearly there were elements of both worked into that segment. And I think with Triple H and Shane, look, we've seen them doing a lot of this kind of stuff lately. John Cena and Roman Reigns are out there doing a work shoot on each other. You're not selling tickets. I'm only here because you can't do your job. You bury young talent. The Miz is on TV a few weeks ago talking about Enzo getting kicked off the tour bus. They're trying to incorporate more elements of reality into this stuff, which I can appreciate. Well, boy, would that make things fun if they did that with Triple H and Shane McMahon. Because you gotta know there that there are underlying feelings, probably on both sides, maybe more so with Shane, where I just don't see how Shane can look at the kind of the lay of the land right now in WWE and how it's his sister and his brother-in-law who are in a position to take over when Vince is out of the picture. I can't see how Shane looks at that and how it doesn't bother him on some level, because Shane was always supposed to be the heir apparent, or at least Shane and Stephanie. They were going to be the heir apparent. And many, many years ago, it seemed like they were kind of grooming Shane even then. You know, they brought in Shane and they would introduce him, and he was building relationships with all the talent behind the scenes, and a lot of the guys liked him and thought he was a cool guy. And you always thought, man, Shane McMahon one day will be in that position. And it didn't quite work out that way. And then he went away for a number of years and only recently came back. And you see all the power that Triple H and Stephanie have within the company. As far as I know, Shane is only an on-air character. I don't think he actually holds any power or has any sort of executive title in the company, at least not yet. What's going to happen when Vince is gone and it's Triple H and Stephanie running the show? Are they going to want Shane in a position of power? Are they worried and not want him to be anywhere near a position of power and they sort of bump him out of the picture? I don't know. I find these questions very intriguing, and I think you can play off of that even if you fake it. And let's say they're totally cool with each other. A lot of people think that there's underlying tension there. So why not play off that? And have them confronting each other in the ring and cutting promos on each other and bringing that up. I just think it would make for a fun build up to what probably would be a fun match. You know, you give it like a no DQ stipulation or something and let them go in there and smoke and mirrors and weapons and stuff, and I think they can have a fun match. So that's the match of the two I would rather see. There really is no other opponent I'm interested in seeing Triple H wrestling at this point except Shane McMahon. Ivan from Central Islip, New York. What is the best year of WCW? That's a loaded question. I don't know if Ivan is talking about best year for business or just my personal favorite year of WCW. If that's what you're asking, then the answer is 1997. I think that was the best overall year for WCW. You had Sting terrorizing Hulk Hogan in the NWO. You had the rise of the Cruiserweights, the Cruiserweight division. They were always fun to watch. I know 98 was the year of Goldberg in WCW, but beyond Goldberg, what was so special about WCW in 98? Right? I get you could find certain things like the rise of DDP. He became a main event player. I'm not saying 98 was an awful year, but I think 97 is really the year that got things kicked into high gear. Best year for WWE, if I had to say, was 2000. I think overall, even without Austin for most of the year 2000 in WWE was probably their best year. Creatively, anyway, probably their best year. Devin from New Jersey, if you had to choose, what would be your top three all-time favorite returns in WWE history? Okay, so he's talking about returns here, not debuts. I mentioned earlier, debuts would be Kane, Jericho, and Taz in that order. Best returns in WWE history. Number one on my list is The Undertaker at Judgment Day 2000 when he came back as the American Badass. I can watch the end of that Iron Man match 1,000 times and never get tired of it. And never get tired of everybody, I think it was in Louisville, just losing their minds, the countdown clock, time's running out, just so dramatic and the place going bonkers, even though they botched the end of the match where time ran out a little too soon and whatever. But I love that. I think that's one of that's one of those all-time moments in WWE where you just sort of get lost in the moment and it's just so much fun. So I would put the Judgment Day 2000 return for Undertaker at number one. I would put Stone Cold's return at Backlash 2000 at number two, which just goes to what I was saying. Literally the last mailbag question I just answered, you know, and I said, what's the best year in WWE? And I said 2000. And so here we have a question where the top two, in my opinion, my two favorite returns, wrestler returns in WWE history, and they both happened not only in the same year, they happened back-to-back months. That's how hot things were, how much fun things were in 2000. You had Austin's return at Backlash, where he came back probably a little sooner than he should have after the neck surgery. He couldn't really do much, but he came out and he beat the hell out of six people with a steel chair and then walked out. It was the longest sustained pop I've ever heard in my life. So from the moment Austin's music hit, everyone's going nuts. Even when he leaves, as he's leaving, Linda McMahon is walking to the ring with Earl Hebner, and then the finish of the match with Rock winning, it was this long, sustained pop that just did not let up for like 5 minutes. So that would be number two on my list. The Undertaker thing happened the very next month, so tells you right there what a fun time it was to be a WWE fan. Number three, I was thinking about this before. I probably would go with Triple H on Raw in 2002 when he came back at Madison Square Garden. That was special. That was special. I wasn't at the Garden that night. I kind of wish I was. Again, people lost their minds and they would not quiet down. Triple H's theme music cycled through like two full times because people just were cheering so loudly. And I wasn't even a big Triple H like fan during that whole period in 2002, but for that one night, that was a pretty incredible reaction to his comeback. So that would be my top three. Let's see here. Derek from Columbus, Ohio. We'll do one more buy or sell. This is a non-wrestling buy or sell. On the better Walking Dead villain, the Governor or Negan? Okay, so I've never read the comics, so I'm going strictly by the TV show with this. So let me just mention that up front. I loved the Governor character. He was an evil SOB, but we got to see different sides of him. The human side, the psychotic side. We learned about his family and the daughter that he kept chained up, right, after she turned. There were actually times I almost felt sympathy for that guy, almost being the key word. With Negan, you know, it's pretty black and white. I mean, he uses people. When they outlive their usefulness or they betray him, he kills them. Other people, he just kills them to make a point. He's an evil son of a bitch. But so far, in the season and a half or whatever it's been that we've seen the character on TV, there isn't really much more to him than that. You know, maybe at some point there will be, you know, at some point in the comics, you know, there's more depth added to the character. We learn more about his background. Because a lot of what they've done on the TV show does mirror the comics. They do take creative license with some things, but that's one of the reasons why I'm not interested in going back right now and reading the comics. I feel like that's just going to spoil what's to come on the TV show. So it's possible at some point we have more layers added to the character, but right now there isn't many layers there. It's pretty straightforward what this guy's all about and what he does. And he is evil, and I think Jeffrey Dean Morgan is tremendous in that role. I think he's great. There's just more to the Governor character than there is to the Negan character. With the Governor, he still had some humanity to him, but the things he does, and that's what made him even scarier in a way, because it's almost like you felt you can sort of get through to him, or you could trust him, or maybe he really is a nice guy or whatever, but he really isn't. He's a sick SOB. With Negan, there's no doubt what he is. You know exactly what he is. You know exactly what you need to do. You need to kill him at the first opportunity that you have. So there's not much more to it than that. But I just found the Governor to be more engaging. I would give the edge to him. It's close. They're both great villains, but I vote for the Governor. See what I did there? vote for the governor. Anyway, that's probably a really good cheesy note to end on here. You can email me your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. The mailbag is always open. I do read everything that you send me, even if it does not make the podcast. Tonight is Hell in a Cell, which means I'll be doing a Sound Off Extra review for the pay-per-view. That will go up later tonight, early tomorrow morning, after Hell in a Cell. So if you want my thoughts on the show, that's the place to go. There's always an MP3 link to download the show directly if you would like to listen to it that way. You gotta go to the YouTube video and grab the link from the video description. I mention that every time, and some people still, oh, how come you don't put the MP3 out there? I do, but you gotta go to the video and grab it. So that'll go up tonight. You could always support the show. Lots of different ways to do that. One way to do that, I don't mention this enough, but I sure would appreciate it if you wanted to leave a 5-star rating. We are a 5-star rated podcast in iTunes. You can leave a 5-star rating. You can leave a written review in iTunes or even on Stitcher. So I would be very grateful to those of you who do that. And again, one more reminder. Do not forget to cash in on that Jim Ross book with our Audible link. This book has been years in the making. It is narrated by the man himself. And if we can get enough people to sign up for the trial with our link, like I said, what a great belated birthday gift that would be. So audibletrial.com/solemonster. The audiobook for Jim Ross, it's called Slobberknocker. You can type in to find it. It is up there. And it is free with a 30-day trial courtesy of our link. So thank you to everybody who goes ahead and does that. We will be back for a brand new podcast. That'll be episode 517 next weekend. So you got that coming up. You've got the Hell in a Cell extra coming up later tonight. 2K18 is out next week for PC. I'll be doing a Sound of Gamer for that. There's something else that I have planned for next weekend that I don't want to really get into right now. That should be fun. So a lot of really good stuff coming up. I appreciate the hell out of all of you who keep listening to my ass every single week. Without you listening to me, there wouldn't be any of this. So I'll see you guys next week. Have yourselves a fantastic Columbus Day for those of you who are lucky enough to have the day off from work. I'm jealous. And we'll be back for more Sound Off next weekend. So until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, "Wait, aren't you going to put any pants on?" He just goes, "No time for pants," and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. You see, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
Solemonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solemonster sounds off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster sound off.